This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
Welcome back, everybody, to another exciting episode of Crimes and Consequences. Hope everybody had a great week. And do we have any business?
Not yet.
Well, not yet. We do. We have true crime business.
Oh, of course. We have that.
So you ready to get to it?
Always ready.
I wanted to change it up a little bit because I'm working on a couple really gruesome episodes for the future. So this one is a mystery that I found fascinating. And with that being said, are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. The setting takes place in a town called Boone. It's a very small town nestled in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina. On February 3rd, 1972, which was a Thursday, it was a little after 10 p.m. when 19-year-old Troy Hall and his new wife, 18-year-old Jenny, were sitting around their trailer watching the Winter Olympics. A blizzard had hit the town. There were blistering 40-mile-an-hour winds, which caused their TV signal to go out. To entertain themselves, Troy put in a music tape in the tape player, and they listened to some songs. The weather had gotten so frigid that it was dangerous. It was a negative 15 degrees.
Oh, that's cold.
That is freaking cold. At this temperature, exposed skin can get frostbite within 10 minutes. So it's very dangerous. After listening to a few songs, Jenny went to the back bedroom to get ready for bed. She was changing out of her clothes and into her pajamas when the phone rang. Troy picked up the receiver and heard a woman who sounded familiar. She sounded a lot like Jenny's 46-year-old mother, Virginia Durham. And she whispered frantically, "Help, three black men have Bobby and Bryce in the back room." Bryce was Jenny's father, and Bobby was her 19-year-old brother. Then the line went dead. Troy yelled out for Jenny, questioning whether her mother would possibly play a joke on him. Jenny didn't think so, and she suggested that they call her mom back. Troy called the Durham house, but all he got was a busy signal. Jenny became worried, and the couple decided that they needed to venture out in the snowstorm and go over to the Durham's home. It was about 2 miles outside of town, just to make sure that the three were all right. And just so everybody knows, the state of North Carolina didn't implement the 911 call system until 1978. Troy and Jenny shared a car. It was parked in the driveway of their trailer. Due to the heavy snowfall, snow had accumulated up to the tire's hubcaps. Even though Troy had only arrived home about 30 minutes earlier, it was just coming down, massive snow. Troy hopped on the driver's side and he turned the ignition. But all it would do was make a clicking sound.
Oh, damn it.
When he tried the headlights, they flickered for a moment, and then they went dim. The battery was clearly dead. Undeterred, the couple trudged through the snow to a trailer of one of their neighbors that they knew. His name was Cecil Small, and he happened to be a private detective. They knocked on his door, and after he answered, they explained the bizarre phone call and asked Cecil if he would be willing to drive them in the hazardous conditions over to Jenny's parents' home. Without hesitation, he agreed. At their suggestion, he brought his revolver in case they ran into trouble. The three piled into Cecil's four-wheel drive vehicle, and they headed to the Durham's house, which was at the bottom of the mountains. took them about 15 minutes to traverse through the 2 miles, just because it was just so shitty out. When they got there, Cecil tried to make it up the Durham's steep driveway, but his car slid down the incline and landing on the road. Cecil told Jenny to wait in the car while he and Troy went to check out the situation. Lights from inside illuminated the split-level house as Troy and Cecil approached the front door. Troy rang the doorbell, but got no answer. He tried to open it, but it was locked. The men drudged around through the thick snow to the back of the home and pounded on the rear kitchen door, but again, they got no answer, and that door was locked. There was a window there in which you could see into the kitchen. However, it was too high, so Cecil had to boost Troy up. When Troy glanced inside, he was shocked to see the kitchen was in complete disarray. He instantly knew something bad had happened. Troy knew of only one other way to get inside the Durham's home, and that was through the 2-car garage. The spring in the door of the garage was broken, so the door was lifted about 18 inches, just high enough for a person to crawl inside. But the two men didn't need to do that, because together they were able to open it. None of the Durham's vehicles were there, which was surprising, because usually in a snowstorm, people stay home. Cecil and Troy walked up the landing that led inside the house. When they opened the door and they went inside, they were just horrified at what they saw. All the pictures on the wall were ripped down. The closet doors were open. The clothes from the closets were thrown all over. Every drawer in the house was opened, and the drawers themselves were ripped out of the dresser, and the drawers were thrown all over. Even the beds were stripped of their bedding, which was piled on the floor. Troy ran into the living room with Cecil following right behind him. They both noticed patches of dried blood on the carpet.
Uh-oh.
The television was on and there was a comedy show playing. In the stillness, Cecil commented that he heard what sounded like water dripping. Troy heard it too and said he thought maybe the sink was overflowing. They followed the noise into the bathroom, where they discovered it wasn't a sink making the sound. It was the bathtub. They stood there. Neither one could move. They were in disbelief by what they were seeing. Kneeled over the lip of the bathtub, with their heads submerged underwater, were the corpses of Bobby, Bryce, and Virginia Durham. All three of the Durhams were motionless. Their hands were tied behind their backs, and the tub's faucet had water pouring from it. But the water was caught by the tub's overflow drain.
So they're all lined up on the side of the tub?
Yes.
With their heads in the water?
Yes.
That's weird.
And it wasn't a large tub. They were crowded there. But I'll get to that. The Durhams had moved to Boone, North Carolina, only 18 months earlier from Mount Airy. That's about an hour and a half away. 51-year-old Bryce had worked in a car loaning business in Mount Airy, but he moved his family to Boone to start a car dealership. Originally, he planned to open the business with an unknown partner, but the partnership fell through. So instead, he decided to just go on his own with Virginia and open up their own dealership. In that bathroom, Cecil and Troy, they just stared at each other as they looked at the Durham's bodies. Cecil thought he heard a noise, so he pulled out his revolver, grabbed Troy by the arm, and dragged him out of the house, because Troy was almost in shock.
Oh, I bet.
For all they knew, the killer or killers could still be inside. As they were leaving, they both noticed that telephone cord had been ripped from the receiver on the kitchen wall. After returning to Cecil's car at the end of the driveway, they told Jenny what happened, and she was obviously horrified. The trio drove to an apartment building nearby and asked a tenant if they could use his phone to call the police. Troy made the call to the sheriff's department and it came in at 10:50 p.m. According to the dispatcher, he was clearly shaken and couldn't seem to get the words out of his mouth fast enough. The State Bureau of Investigations, that's the SBI, and the sheriff's department arrived to the Durham's home shortly after 11, and they began their investigation. The arriving officers came in through the front door, and neatly placed by the door were Bobby's laced-up Oxfords and Virginia's knee-high fashion boots. The soles of their shoes were still damp from the snow. Bryce wore totes. You know what tote is? Totes are those rubber shoes that are placed over your regular shoes.
Okay.
You know, people actually wore those. That'd be hard to get your foot in there.
Right.
Anyway, Bryce's shoes were found upstairs in his bedroom next to his winter coat that was hanging over his closet door. Within steps of entering, officers could see the three bodies crowded around the bathtub through the opened bathroom door. Bobby was closest to the drain. His father was next to him. And Virginia was sort of jammed in the end by the wall. She was almost a little bit on top of Bryce. Investigators pulled Virginia out of the tub. When they did, they discovered she had a nylon rope, 1/4 inch thick, placed around her neck. It was later determined that it was her blood found in the living room on the shag carpet. When Bryce was pulled out of the tub, he had an injury to his nose, a 6-foot-long rope wrapped loosely around his neck like a noose. There was a knot in it. According to his autopsy, he had undigested chicken, corn, and squash in his stomach. There were rope burns on his neck, water in his lungs, and bruising on his forehead. He had been hit with something, whether a fist or an object, on his head. And again, there was a cut on his nose, which most likely came from being punched in the face while wearing his glasses. His cause of death, Tanya, it was listed as asphyxia due to rope strangulation and drowning. Basically, his head had been plunged into the bathtub water while a noose was placed around his neck. So he was strangled and drowned at the same time.
That's crazy.
Yeah, like what a complicated way to kill somebody.
Right, exactly.
There was no water outside the tub area on the floor.
There wasn't?
No.
See, you would think if someone's trying to drown another person, that person would be fighting for their life, especially if the tub is full, right? There should be water everywhere.
That's what adds to this mystery. Investigators concluded that none of the victims put up a struggle in the bathroom.
Huh.
Virginia's autopsy showed that she had died from strangulation, and she was already dead when her head was placed in the tub. I don't know why someone would do that, except to maybe make sure she was dead.
Maybe.
She had a bruise on the right side of her cheek, along with an injury to her nose, most likely a result of multiple punching to the head. Her knees also had bruising on them, and there was a cut on her chin. College freshman Bobby, he died in a similar fashion to his father. Now, Bobby was a football player in high school. He was athletic, yet it appears he didn't struggle either. His killer or killers fashioned a rope around his neck, strangling and drowning him at the same time in the bathtub. Besides rope burns around Bobby's neck, he had some on his face too. These burns suggested that a rope had served as a gag at one point and had been tied around his mouth to the back of his head.
Weird.
Police surmised that they were forced into the tub in the order they were found. And I don't know what led them to this conclusion, but they believe Bobby was the first one to be forced in the bathroom, strangled and drowned, then Bryce, and then Virginia. How did someone manage to overpower three people?
That's what I want to know.
As I said, Bobby was strong, athletic. He was a former Eagle Scout. And what's really interesting is somehow they were all three murdered within a 25 to 30 minute time span from when Virginia placed the call. It takes about 4 minutes for someone to die from strangulation. And you have three people that were killed at three different times. At least that's what the police think. Investigators scouted the rest of the crime scene. In the living room on the coffee table were two full glasses of Coke and one glass that was half full or half empty, depending on your perspective. Next to the half full, half empty glass of pop was a partially eaten plate of baked chicken. The rest of the chicken lay on the counter in the kitchen. Also found on the coffee table were some playing cards. Now, Bobby was a big fan of solitaire, and he had recently told his sister Jenny he was determined to beat the game, so the cards were probably his. Some of the cards were found scattered on the floor. In the hallway that led to the living room lay Bryce's reading glasses, broken at the bridge, probably from the punch. Nothing, and when I say nothing, Tanya, I mean nothing in that house had been left untouched by the perpetrator's perpetrator, including the basement. In the basement, there was this open bread box, and investigators believe that it probably contained something of value the way it was placed, but I don't know exactly what leads them to that. They found latent fingerprints on it. As I mentioned earlier, their bedding was ripped off their beds. Why would you need to rip off sheets? It doesn't make any sense. All the drawers had been ransacked and removed, but the most revealing piece of evidence was a bullet hole found by the police. The police didn't release a lot of information to the public about it, but I do know a gun was fired in that home. Bryce and Bobby's wallets had been rifled through, but the wallet itself was left behind. Now, this is what's really strange about this.
As if this whole story isn't strange.
Well, you're thinking, okay, this sounds like over the top.
Home invasion.
Home invasion. But this is where it gets odd. In plain sight, on a dining room chair, was a bank deposit bag filled with receipts and cash from the Buick Pontiac dealership sales that day.
There's money?
Cash. Right there on a dining room chair, left behind.
And considering they went through everything.
Everything.
They didn't miss that.
They even took the pictures off the
right.
wall. Which maybe they were looking for a safe. I mean, why are you taking pictures off a wall?
Sometimes people hide money behind pictures.
Oh.
I know people who've done that.
I'm going to have to take a look at your house sometime, Tanya.
There isn't any at my house. You're going to be very disappointed if you look behind any photos in my house.
You're going to catch me at your house sometime. Just peeking.
Just peeking.
Now, normally, Bryce or Virginia would make a nightly deposit after work with the bank deposit bag. But due to the really horrendous weather conditions, they decided to wait until the morning. At first glance, this house appears to be ransacked. But after further investigation, a few seasoned officers thought the extent of the chaos was just too much for a simple home invasion. And to them, the scene appeared staged. Word of the murder spread through Boone like wildfire. Within an hour of the police arriving on the scene, a tip came in to the sheriff's department regarding one of the Durham's missing vehicles. It was from a local man who had heard a report about the murders on the radio. He told the police that around 11 p.m., he left his house in the country and he headed down a dirt road to pick up his son who was in town. So he's making his way to town. As he's driving, he spots a green and white Jimmy truck on the side of the road. It's a GMC.
Mm-hmm.
Four-wheel vehicle. So everybody knows this Jimmy truck was like a brand new thing in 1972. It was like a big deal. He made his way to town. He picked up his son. And on their return home, he noticed the car was still there. He was worried someone might be stuck in the ditch. So he stopped to offer help. The Jimmy was still running. Its windshield wipers were on. But no one was in or around the vehicle. The tipster gave the location of the Jimmy to the police, and a patrol officer was dispatched to the area. He found the vehicle exactly where the man said it would be, which was only a mile away from the Durham home. There were skid marks indicating that the right tire slid into the ditch, and the ditch was kind of deep, So once that tire got in there, it wasn't going to get out. Even more telling was the fact there was a second set of tire tracks right behind the Jimmy. They didn't come from that Good Samaritan who had stopped. The doors of the vehicle were shut, but they weren't locked. Inside the backseat, investigators found a pillowcase filled with some of the Durham silver platters and a few other valuables. But there were no jewels and gems involved in gold.
Cash that was sitting right in the dining room.
Yes! Later, investigators found Bobby's car, because he had his own car, and the car Bryce and Virginia shared. Those cars were found at the car dealership parking lot during their investigation. Tracking dogs were brought to the Durham home. And it's really interesting. They were made to circle a hollow area in the Durham's backyard because they didn't have a scent to go off of. You know, normally they'll have a piece of clothing or an item from someone and they can track that scent. So basically the handlers were trying to find a scent, which I didn't know they could actually do. So they had them circle this hollow area where they believe the perpetrator or perpetrators were at. And then once these dogs were let off their leash, from there, they led the police through the Durham's backyard tree line, through a pasture and over a fence, where they ended up on a dead-end dirt road, not very far from the crime scene. There were tire tracks matching the tread found behind the Jimmy there on that small dirt road. But before I tell you more, we're going to take a quick break. As I was saying, the tire tracks on the dirt road match the ones behind the Jimmy. Something that I thought was very interesting is they found these tire tracks, but they never found any footprints. The police said the footprints were erased by the heavy snowfall and the 40-mile-an-hour winds, but I don't know why the tire tracks weren't.
Right, because, I mean, if they are disposing of a car and leaving it running, there had to have been footprints.
Right, obviously. So, and I also want to say really quick that I did a lot of research on this case, and there's different facts depending on what you read. I found a very lengthy article in the Herald that I thought was the most accurate. It was written only a few months after the crimes, and it had lots of quotes from the sheriff and stuff, so I'm using the Herald article. The police couldn't come up with any motives for the bizarre murders. Bryce was a former Navy vet who served in World War II, and he had no criminal background or any history of violence. Bobby was your all-American great kid, and Virginia was described as a strong woman and loving mother. Rumors were flying about Bryce being involved in dubious business activities, horse track betting, rolling back miles on cars he sold. However, police found no evidence at all of anything illegal or otherwise with Bryce. The police announced a reward of $17,000. It had been brought together by community business owners. That's equivalent of $110,000 by today's standards. That was offered to anyone who provided information leading to a resolution in this case. The most prominent theory with investigators was that their death was a professional hit job by someone who held a grudge against them. The ransacking was just a red herring to throw the investigation off. Others believed it was a burglary gone wrong. But if so, why leave the money behind? Are you just that goddamn stupid?
I know.
You didn't see the bag of cash?
Exactly. They've been through the entire house. You know they saw a bag.
It's a bank deposit
yes.
bag, by the way.
Exactly. I mean, it's obvious.
Maybe in the frenzy they just forgot it or missed it somehow. Still, another theory rampant in the police force and with the townspeople included Troy as the instigator of the murders. And there's some merit to it. Let me tell you why. It was no secret that the Durhams were very unhappy that their daughter, Ginny, had married him. One family member of the Durhams described Troy as, quote, being real mean. Questions were raised as to why the couple didn't call the police after Virginia's distressing phone call.
I wondered that myself.
Instead of going in a snowstorm to see. And then also, why didn't Virginia call the police instead of her daughter's house? But again, there was no 911 phone system in place. Anyway, because any call from the Durhams to Troy and Ginny would be a local call, it couldn't be verified in 1972. Only long-distance calls left a record. So police couldn't even tell for sure if a call took place from Virginia to the trailer.
Because Ginny was getting her pajamas on.
Exactly. They had to take Troy's word for it. Many people wondered if there was a call, if it was a signal for Troy that the murders were complete. Troy's behavior after the murders didn't sit well with the community, and he didn't do much to gain any support from them. Although he spoke with police on the night of the murders, he lawyered up afterwards and refused to talk. However, after about 4 months, he did sit down with his lawyer and talk to the police. Now, Ginny, she's the sole heir to the Durhams estate. She inherited $250,000, which is the equivalent of $1.6 million today.
Wow.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money.
That's a shit ton of money.
Yes.
In the months leading up to the murders, her relationship with her parents had been strained. They were usually a very close family. But since she married Troy, she'd only seen her family a few times. And it didn't help that Ginny decided to drop out of college. In fact, on the day of the murder, her dad had given her a lecture about that. That day, Ginny was working in the afternoon at the Appalachian State University. She didn't go there. She dropped out. She was working there. When it was time for her to go home, she was concerned how she was going to get home because Troy had the car that they shared and it was really bad out. Normally, she would call Troy when she was done and he would come and get her. But Troy had just gotten over the flu and Ginny thought it'd be best for him not to leave the house. So she called her dad instead. And this was sometime around 4:30. However, Troy did leave the house. According to Troy, he left between 4:30 and 5 to go study at the Appalachian State University Library, where Ginny was working. He was a student there.
That seems suspicious to me.
This begs the question.
Is it snowing, right?
Yes, it's snowing. It's a blizzard.
Yes. Why would you go to school to study in a blizzard?
I know. He's just living at home with his wife.
She's not going to bother him.
Maybe he needed the books.
Oh, maybe. Maybe he had to do some research because the internet didn't exist back then too, right?
That very valid point.
I will give him a break on that one.
But the question remains, how did he think Ginny was going to get home? She didn't call him. Normally she does. Why didn't he pick her up from work? He's where she's working. Witnesses can place him at the university library until 8 p.m. However, we know he didn't come home until 9:55 p.m. That doesn't mean he wasn't at the library. It's just no one can place him there. As I said, Bryce was working at the dealership when he received a call from Ginny. He told her, "I'll pick you up. I'll be there in about 30 minutes. And by this time, the snow was so heavy you could barely see your hand in front of your face. When you add in the wind, 40 miles an hour, it's a nightmare.
What time did they say that they were murdered?
About 10:30.
Okay.
True to his word, a half hour after Ginny called, Bryce pulled up to the campus parking lot, driving the Jimmy, and Ginny had never seen the Jimmy before. It was a brand new green and white GMC Jimmy truck that had been delivered to that car lot that day. He borrowed the truck from his business because it could handle the icy roads much better than his sedan. Ginny hopped into the truck and the two headed to the Greenway Village trailer park in town where she lived. During their drive, Bryce had a serious conversation with Ginny about the direction of her life and the necessity that she go back to college. According to Ginny, she told her father she would start back up at school the next semester. And he was, quote, pleased tremendously. He dropped her off at home and he headed back to the dealership. Now remember, he pulled into the dealership at 5:45. And just so you remember the timeline, Troy got home at 9:55. The phone call from Virginia was at 10:15. And about 25 to 30 minutes later, Cecil, Troy, and Ginny made it to the Durham's home. When Bryce got inside the dealership, he saw Bobby was there. Bobby was studying in the sales room. He planned on going over to a friend's house for dinner and catching a basketball game afterwards. Virginia, she was the secretary and the bookkeeper for the dealership, and she was in the office working on the books. We know this because an employee was there. Virginia got a phone call from their lawyer, just discussing some business things around 6 o'clock, and she seemed fine to him. Virginia told Bobby she didn't think it was a good idea that he go to his friend's house or to that basketball game. That decision cost Bobby his life. Bryce later left the dealership, and this is a little weird. He wanted to attend an 8 p.m. Rotary Club meeting at the Appalachian Ski Mountain Resort.
They're still having a meeting?
Well, when he got there, he found out it was canceled.
I was going to say.
But he was clearly a devoted member.
It was very important to him.
Another Rotarian followed behind Bryce as he drove home. This guy used the jimmy to block the snow and make a path for him. This Rotarian reported to the police that he followed Bryce to the dealership and they got there at about 8:30. Then he went his own way. From there, Bryce picked up Bobby and Virginia and drove them home. Although it was only a 2-mile drive, given the road conditions, police estimate that it took them between 20 to 30 minutes to get there, putting them at their home about 9 o'clock. Neighbors watching TV at the time recall seeing someone drive towards the Durham home at around that time, and they believe that is when the family got home. Now at 10:20, the same neighbors' dogs began barking really loudly. But the neighbors couldn't see or hear anything outside because of the wind and the snow. The wind was howling. They stated that their dogs would only bark, in their opinion, if someone was approaching their home, too. Local police and the FBI devoted all of their manpower to catching the people responsible for the murder. They even used the assistance of a Dutch clairvoyant. His name was M.B. Dijkshoorn. He flew in to help. The police said this clairvoyant was surprisingly helpful. On his own, he was able to pinpoint the exact location of where the truck was found. The clairvoyant said 5 people were involved with a crime. And the police didn't really say what else was helpful about it. All I saw was an interview with the sheriff who said it was surprisingly helpful to have the clairvoyant. On April 18th, 2 months after the murder, a detective working on the case returned to his office to find 2 messages. They were from a man named Dean Chandler, who was in the Asheville jail. Dean was 22 years old, and he was one of 12 men arrested in the days and weeks after the murder as part of the FBI's investigation into a large-scale professional thievery gang. All the men had been questioned before about the murders, and they denied any involvement. But the detective called up and was able to speak with Dean. Dean said, "You know, I lied the first time. I'm going to tell the truth now." He said, "I want to come clean. But in order for me to tell the truth, I'm going to have you drop a few charges that are out there against me right now. And my wife." There were some charges against his young wife, Anne. This is what Dean says happened. He'd been casing the Durham's house as part of the burglary ring he operated in. That was his job, is to case them out. On the night of the murders, Dean and his 20-year-old wife, Ann, they met 3 men, Jerry Casada, Dewey Coffey, who's 21, and Eugene Garin, who's 22. All these men were young. I don't know how old Jerry was, but he's like 21. They met just off a highway. Now, I want to point out that all 3 of these men are Caucasian.
Okay.
When Dean met with the 3 men, he provided detailed information about the Durham house, including the dirt road that was not far from it. He explained how they should go about burglarizing it, And I don't know why he picked their house. And then Dean and his wife parted ways from the men. They all met up at 11 o'clock. Dean claims by happenstance. Mm-hmm. He was driving down the road and he saw their car. That's what he says. He saw their car. He started following them. They pulled over and the ringleader, Jerry, pulled out a gun. Dean says, well, hey, you know me, because the snow is blowing and blah, blah, blah. He said, you know me. And Dean hops in to their car and follows behind in their Plymouth. So she's driving in the snowstorm all by herself in some sedan. Dean claims that Jerry said they had, quote, messed the whole deal up. He openly talked about firing a gun, wearing brown gloves, stealing the Jimmy, and stealing silver. Dean says that one of the men's jackets that they were wearing in the car while Dean was sitting there was wet up to the elbows, and his pants were wet, too. Either Dewey or Eugene, according to Dean, said, quote, if they would have just came home 5 minutes later, none of this would have happened, end quote. Insinuating that they had been somewhere in the house already when the Durhams arrived home. The four men pulled into Jerry's driveway and he ran inside to change his clothes. He came back out holding a bag containing a blue shirt and brown pants and instructed Dean to take them and burn them on the mountain, which Dean later did. This is interesting. The police went to the area on the mountain and they found charred clothes, verifying at least that aspect of the story. Dean's wife, Anne, also spoke with police, and she said that Jerry approached her in March while she was walking, and he told her, basically, we killed the Durhams, and if we go down for it, you're going to go down for it, and you'll never see your children again. That's what Anne says. Based on Anne and Dean's confession, Jerry, Dewey, and Eugene were arrested for the murder. But to Dean's surprise, he was arrested too. He was arrested as an accessory after the fact. What a dumbass!
What a dumbass.
Jesus! After Dean got arrested, Anne basically quit cooperating with the police. There was a preliminary hearing and she pled the fifth. Dean tried to get his confession thrown out.
Of course.
Dewey and Eugene, they passed lie detector tests. And based on that, and the fact that the only evidence against them was Dean's testimony, the judge dismissed all the charges against them for lack of evidence. However, Jerry Casada, he faced 3 counts of first-degree premeditated murder, and Dean still faced charges of accessory after the fact. While the men were awaiting these charges, Dean was sentenced to 5 years for car theft. They also stole vehicles. In 1974, 2 years later, the charges against Dean and Jerry were dropped for insufficient evidence. So what's transpired in the last 50 years with this case, and where does it stand now? I know you want to know.
Of course I do.
And I have a little more to add. In 1976, Troy and Jenny Hall divorced. Troy moved to Georgia and changed his name to Justin. In 1979, he became an attorney.
Oh, interesting.
And an owner of his own construction business. He died in 2019. Jenny remarried a man named Steve, and she moved to the state of Washington. She has always cooperated with authorities. She even allowed herself to be hypnotized, but there was just nothing for her to add. In 1983, an FBI profiler spent 12 hours going over the evidence with investigators. He really didn't have much to offer, and the police were pretty disappointed. He said that the perpetrator or perpetrators felt comfortable in the house. Police were like, what does that mean? Are they comfortable because they're sociopaths? Are they comfortable because they do this all the time? Are they comfortable because they know the victims in the house? What does that mean?
What does that mean?
And then the profiler, don't know who he is, but he said that the longer the perpetrator or perpetrators can go without confessing, easier it becomes to deal with what they have done until it's almost like an out-of-body experience that someone else did.
I would think that would be obvious.
Thank you. I'm just like, this is called denial.
Yes, exactly. Denial. Something you did 50 years ago.
Did I do that?
Yeah.
Mm. I can't even remember what I did yesterday. Rumors continue to swirl to this day about what happened. What was the motive for the murders? Some believe it was the work of the Green Berets.
What?
They were in town doing a ski demonstration and were at that resort where the Rotary Club meeting was supposed to be held. And people base that on the way that they were tied up and drowned.
So the Green Berets are just doing it for a night of fun?
Like, why? Okay, well, that theory was dismissed, Tanya.
It's stupid.
I'm just telling you all. One of the original investigators was asked in an interview what he believed took place. What happened? And he said that he, to this day, believes that the right guys were arrested.
Mm.
But what's interesting, Tanya, is there were some fingerprints found in the Jimmy and found at the house. It didn't match any of them. Every year, the police and the FBI, they run those fingerprints through a database. There's never been a match.
Well, I was thinking their timeline is off. Because if Dean said that one of the guys told him, if they had only came home 5 minutes later.
Exactly.
And that would have... You said they came home at 9.
Right.
Or right around 9. But then the call that Virginia made was at 10:15.
Plus they sat around and ate chicken.
Right. Oh, that's true.
And they were watching TV and playing cards. So one of the investigators, he believes it was part of that thievery gang. And he also believes that Troy put them up to it. That's what he thinks. I don't know. I saw an article and one of Troy's family members posted that he would never have done anything like that. Now, the former attorney general for North Carolina, he became involved in the case earlier in his career. And he firmly maintains that it was a professional hit job. He said, you don't go out on a snowy night like that in Boone and just drive by the Durham house and say, let's go rob that place. What would make someone or people in a blizzard rob a place? Investigators agree on a few things. They believe a minimum of 2 people entered the house. They entered it through the 18-inch gap from the garage door. They surprised Virginia, Bobby, and Bryce as they were sitting around the living room, and then they brutally murdered them one by one. Now, many people wonder if Virginia wasn't knocked unconscious after those 2 blows to her head, or maybe she'd already been strangled and then popped back up, confused. Bryce and Bobby were in the bathroom, so maybe she said bathroom instead of back room. Either way, somehow she was able to get to a phone, and then the perps caught her and ripped the receiver out and then maybe strangled her right then and there. That's about it. That's it. I got no answers.
Damn it, Talia.
I can come up with some bullshit. I don't have a theory. I mean, if you think about it, Troy had no criminal record. They all agree that Jenny did everything she could to help and was devastated. And then what Dean said doesn't make any sense.
No, I'm confused.
Someone in a blizzard took their time at that house. They had to have been there a while. If you see pictures, which you can go to our website, tntcrimes.com, and you can look. This house, it takes time to mess up a house. It takes my kids at least 10 minutes. And then it takes time to strangle people.
And drown someone.
And drown someone.
Individually.
Yes.
I'm confused. I wish I had the answer. This is a crazy case.
I know. So anyway, that is the story of the Durham family murders in Boone, North Carolina. I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank you, Tanya, for listening. You guys can learn more about the case by going to our website, TNT Crimes. You can see some posts on our Instagram and Facebook account at Hardcore True Crime. And if you like this story and you want other stories like this that aren't released to the public, we have almost 70. If you don't mind the F word and a little more vulgarity, you can become one of our members. And you can do that by going to patreon.com/TNT crimes, because I'm a T and Tanya's
a T.
And together we're TNT. So you go to patreon.com/TNT crimes or our website and you can learn more. And all the money from our membership helps us support us, because even though you hear these commercials, we don't get paid diddly squat for them. Just enough to pay the light bill, right, yeah, Tanya? Right,
exactly.
Maybe a Diet Coke here and there or a beer. You can go to our website and buy us a martini.
If you don't want to become a member.
If you don't want to become a member.
You still want to support us.
I like more than one martini. Anyway.
Definitely. If you're going to have one, you need to have like three or four.
I've seen you with three or four. No, you don't. One's enough. Stop her. Anything else, Tanya?
No, I don't think so.
All right. On that note, don't kill each other.
Until our next episode.
Bye.
Bye.